good day? Good night.
Oh, you took all the times. Good morrow.
I went
Victorian. How are you? They still can't answer me.
They still can't. A year on and they still can't answer you.
A year on. It's our birthday.
It is our birthday.
It might even be our birthday when you hear it.
Probably not, but
no, we're thinking positive today. This is going up on time.
Yeah.
I'm not going to tell him when our birthday is, just in case.
We're keeping it on the DL, on the down low.
They could just go back and look at our first episode, but why would they do that?
You guys aren't that committed to this podcast, no. Neither are we.
No, clearly. So.
So, how was your Halloween, Portia?
In my faith, we don't celebrate Halloween.
Is your faith Christmas and birthdays only?
My faith is British. I'm not really faithful, listeners. I don't really do it. I've never done it really. It's not a thing for me.
Fair enough.
Yeah. What did I do Halloween day / night? I think, I was home alone and I was like, this year I'm going to force myself to watch a horror film. And then I was like, let me just watch Super Nanny. Just one Super Nanny, just to get a hit, and then I'll be fine. And then I watch like six Super Nannies and went to bed. So
fair enough.
But some may argue that the real horror is naughty children.
I completely agree.
So
I was really sick. I still am really sick.
Yes.
I don't think I'm ever not going to be sick. This is my life now. So we did one of my favourite things to do on Halloween. We watched The Shining. 10 years I'd never seen it.
But that is madness to me.
I know. So we watched The Shining. The Shining.
Ooh. The Shining.
The Shining. I watched it for the first time. Not for the first time. That's a complete, utter bullshit lie. My first Halloween as a student, I went to the cinema to watch The Shining.
Ah.
And when I read the book, it was Halloween as well.
Aww.
Yeah, so it's got a little bit of a...
Dearly.
What's that?
I love The Shining dearly. I went to the Stanley Kubrick exhibition a couple of months ago in the Design Museum in London. Very good. I saw the big, like, model, mini model.
Of the
grounds and the maze, yeah.
Oh.
And they had the typewriter with the and the pile of papers with all work and no play. I was gonna say all jack and no play.
It is all jack and
all jack and no work makes play a
dull
a boy dull. and they had the outfits. They had the twins dresses and
they
had
the twins. It says at the beginning of the film they're 8 and 10. Who dresses their 8 and 10?
The actresses were twins, though.
No, they're different heights.
They're not. They're twins, it said in the exhibition.
Oh.
Why would they...
But they're not...
Why would they hire twins to play not twins?
I don't know. It's fucking bizarre.
Cool behaviour.
I know. Because I was like, the twins are coming up. I was like, these aren't twins. They're 8 and 10.
I take back everything I said. Stanley Kubrick is a fool. He's a downright fraud. He's a hack. Ah!
So... Topically,
yeah. What the fuck was that noise? Don't talk to me about topics. Yes.
You're not going to edit out all the coughs.
I'm not editing, mate. It's all happening.
I apologise, everyone. Topically, what we are doing for our anniversary / our very late Halloween episode is we are talking about scary movies and creepy things that may have happened during the filming of, or whether they were based on true stories.
We should explain that setup, actually. We thought we were going to do a Halloween episode, but since it's our birthday today, we were like, there's a week in it, what's the point? So, because we wanted to do something to mark our first ever birthday, because not only is it our first birthday, But this is the longest we've ever stuck to anything in our lives, ever, including relationships on my part. So, you know, this is really something to celebrate. So we were like, okay, we'll do it for our birthday and it'll kind of be a joint Halloween birthday thing.
Which is what it's going to be every year.
Yeah, expect that, because our birthday's like
when
the same
day your birthday's
year.
On the 21st of December and yeah. You just don't have a birthday.
You don't
for the
have
rest
presents for Christmas, really, because it's like birthday or vice versa.
No, you don't have presents for your birthday because it's Christmas, let's be real.
Mm. My brother's birthday is in December and he has shitloads for Easter to make up for.
My ex-boyfriend's birthday is Christmas Eve.
Oh, fuck.
And because his grandparents live in Scotland, he often spends his Christmas Eve in the car.
Oh, God.
His birthday, rather.
Oh.
Same day, as I mentioned.
Yeah.
So, shall I start?
Yes. not gonna do one each this year, this month, this episode. We're gonna tennis it. We're gonna be like Pong. Remember the first ever video game Pong? We're gonna be like that.
I
think
you went from tennis to a game based on tennis.
I didn't even go for ping pong. We're gonna do
that
with bounce.
Do you guys remember Pong?
You may have heard of tennis. We're gonna bounce back and forth like Roger fucking Federer. Let's go. What is going on?
All right. So, well, speaking of The Shining, that seems like a good place to start.
Yay. I messed up that segue, didn't I? I'm sorry. I inserted too much material in between.
No, it works. It works. It's fine. It's fine. I didn't plan that at all. That is what I did at Halloween, though, so it works.
Yeah.
It works. So, The Shining is a movie from 1980, directed by the one and only...
Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah, based on the novel written by the one and only Stephen King.
Yeah. Oh yeah, of course.
You know this.
I do.
There are a lot of differences between the movie and the book. Stephen King hates them all. And
No, I'd never say a bad thing about Stephen King. He's the most realistic looking Who from Whoville in the world, isn't he? Doesn't he look like a Who?
He does look like a Who.
Yeah. He's a cute one.
He is a cute one, and he hates the Tories, so...
Does he? My man
King.
We are apolitical on this podcast, but we fucking hate the Tories.
That's understandable, though. Who doesn't, am I right? So, King hated most of the changes made, because they did seem really... like, didn't really make much sense. So I'm going to start by talking about Shelley Duvall.
Okay. Terrible actor.
Oh my god. I am so upset about what happened to Wendy between the book and the film because she was so strong in the book.
Was she really?
Yeah, she and Shelley Duvall is a fucking wet towel.
I've never rooted for a villain so much in my life.
just accent. Just.
I want to smash your brains in and she's not even the light of my life.
So, everyone has always said in the past that Stanley Kubrick is a very good director to work with. The exception being his treatment of Shelley Duvall during The Shining. And you can see it in the backstage footage on clips and stuff, he berates her constantly. To the point where her hair was falling out.
Oh, shit.
She was actually forced to do the bat scene, the Gimme the Bat scene with Jack Torrance walking up the stairs 127 times.
Oh.
So it led her to like this really big anxious mental breakdown. So some people think
I was gonna liken that, but I'm not gonna. Never mind.
What?
Oh, that's also stupid.
You gonna say that?
I was gonna say that also happened in Pacific Rim. But never mind. I can't compare the two really.
Same thing.
Yeah.
So it's some people think that Kubrick was doing it to sort of express to Shelley Duvall the sort of stress that Jack Torrance was under.
I wonder if he was trying to express that she's a terrible actor.
Yeah, maybe it was just that she was just fucking shite.
Yeah.
Which I prefer.
I want to make her hair fall out. I hate her.
and other little known, I say little known, I knew it, you probably knew it, Danny, little known fact is the word I was missing from that sentence.
little known Danny.
Danny actually didn't know he was filming a horror movie until he was like an adult.
That's really cute.
It's so adorable. Anyway, so...
Why did he think they were making him scream though? And... Is that why he's such a terrible he's got such a terrible shocked face when he does that thing where he's like it's really bad.
It's probably someone going, open your mouth wide.
Yeah. Attention the dentist.
So one interesting thing that happened during the film of The Shining towards the end is that a huge fire broke out.
Oh shit.
And destroyed multiple sets. Each soundstage is like 2.5 million worth of damage, and two of those were destroyed, plus some other stuff. One of those sets was the set that they used for the bat scene.
Oh, Shelley.
Shelley must have set the fire.
Did they check at home for jerry cans?
They probably didn't. She was continuously smoking on set though, so in the movie, so no cause of the fire was found at all. But what's particularly interesting about this is maybe pause if you don't want to hear spoilers for the book.
Oh, I'm not being funny. Just assume this is going to be full of spoilers for everything talk about.
In the movie ends with Jack Torrance dying, being frozen to death in the maze outside the Overlook Hotel. But in the book, one of the main themes is Jack's main role in the hotel was to run the boiler, because it's a very sensitive boiler to heat the whole hotel. As he loses control over his mental capacity, this is sort of echoed in the rising pressure in the boiler throughout the movie, which culminates in the boiler exploding and the hotel burning down. Which is why
In the book?
Yeah.
How does he show you that the pressure's building?
Because he's not... I can't remember.
Cut to the boiler room where the boiler's now at 23 pressures.
Well, I think he was just not checking the boiler. I don't know. I can't remember, mate. It was years ago that I read the book.
Jack's having a very stressful day, and also the boiler is really dense.
That's exactly how King writes. You can tell that you're an avid fan.
Anyone could do it. I do enjoy his books, but I can't read. I'm not a big reader.
But also, I'm illiterate.
Yeah. Also, I've never read a book in my life. I just assume I like them.
But yeah, it's interesting that the set was burned down in the same way that the book ended.
It did in the book. Someone who was really passionate about being faithful to the book.
I wonder who it could have been. Someone who was berated throughout filming by the director.
And constantly smoking.
There's a great picture of Stanley Kubrick just laughing outside the burned down thing. he sees the irony in what happened. Check out our Instagram, Dead Square Podcast, for that image.
And other good stuff.
And other good stuff. But there's a lot of conspiracy theories based around The Shining. Because of the way this Kubrick does his directing and stuff, and the sort of messages he leaves in movies.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of theories about The Shining. My absolute favourite is that The Shining is Kubrick's veiled confession to how he helped with the moon landing. Faking the filming of the moon landing.
I'm familiar with the conspiracy.
The theory is that 2001 Space Odyssey was actually a research mission to capture footage for the Apollo footage. It all makes sense. And that every time Kubrick deviated from the King novel, he was alluding to his involvement in... Which I do not understand, because I don't understand what a frozen maze... The maze isn't in the book.
It
has anything to do with
the
moon.
Maze of his mind in which
he was lost, keeping up the secret.
And let's just quickly... I was going to reference an episode that's not out yet. Why would he do that? Why would he give you clues to something that he was obviously supposed to keep secret? Why would he do it?
Why wouldn't you? You want to let the world know. So, apparently, the theory is that he had an argument with his wife based on this when she found out, where she was very mad at him for faking the moon landing.
Just classic domestic dispute.
Yeah. And the lines that Jack says to Wendy when she suggests taking Danny to a doctor. Wendy, that's just so typical of you. Don't you know I have an obligation to my employers? Do you know what a contract is? That's my Jack Nicholson impression. That tirade is supposed to be Stanley telling his wife why he had to... it's not a leap. I don't know what you're talking about.
I mean, look, show me one devoted husband who's never slipped an angry gesture to his wife into a film instead of saying it to her face.
I think that they had this conversation.
And then he just ripped it off. He couldn't think of...
I mean, the man's completely unoriginal.
Yeah.
So...
Right, well, you know, Stanley.
There's also... You know the scene where...
I know the scene.
Of course you do. Where Danny's playing with his trucks.
Mm-hmm.
And he's on those hexagons.
Yeah.
And he stands up.
That's a weird way of talking about the carpet. He's on those hexagons.
He's on those hexagons.
Old Danny's on them hexagons again. It's like a drug.
Well, when Danny stands up after a ball is rolled towards his feet.
Briefly before the fantastic silent scream.
He stands up, revealing he is wearing
an Apollo jumper
with an aeroplane, a space aeroplane.
You've seen that? That was in the thing, a jumper.
Was it really?
Yeah.
But as he goes to stand up, it looks like it's taking off. As he heads towards room 237, also known as the moon room. Let me tell you about the moon room. So, first of all, do you know why the room is 237 in the Overlook Hotel in the movie, as opposed to 217, which it is in the book?
I do, but I can't remember.
That's fair enough. It's because the Mount Hood Resort, which is where the Overlook, was filmed, where The Shining was filmed, they didn't want... They had a room...
Yeah, it's a fake room, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They didn't want people being too afraid to sleep in a room, so they said, can you change it from 217 to 237? That's the theory, because they didn't have a room 237. Yeah. But if you were to ring the Mount Hood Resort, apparently, they would tell you that there isn't even a room 217.
No.
Apparently.
Did you ring them?
So I personally did not.
Where's the devotion to this podcast?
I'm starting to doubt
your commitment to Spark Emotion better then. Why didn't we call it Spark Emotion? Dead is a shit name and there's 700 deadies.
Ours is the best deadie. I was so proud of that name. Please don't take it away from me.
Fantastic. I'm not going to lie.
So the theory is the Kubrick changed the name to 237 to reflect the stage on which they worked when filming the moon landings. And also the moon is 237,000 miles from Earth. Coincidence?
I think not.
So Danny the Rocket goes down the corridor to room 237, where he sees the door jar and a key in the lock. On the lock, as imaged here, it's the words room n little o 237.
Yep. I've got that. It doesn't look like that. But
I know.
It.
I'm a bit disappointed it doesn't look like that.
Mine's nicer though. That's crap.
Yeah, get away. So, using the capital letters, ignoring the little O from no, the only words that can be made from those letters. This is on fucking documentary, mate. People paid money to commit this to people's minds. The only words that could be made are room, and moon, thus making this the moon room.
Is this on that documentary that's called Room 237? Oh, I want to see that. I still haven't seen it.
I didn't watch it all because it was like 3 hours, but I just picked up my favourite part.
That was like a really legit thing. It was like in the cinema, like mainstream cinema.
And this is in that legitimate documentary.
That's absurd. So I've got to watch it.
Dan is on YouTube.
No way! Mm-hmm. Oh, we're adding that to the list.
Danny is forbidden from entering to 237. Just as nobody is allowed to know what happened in the moon.
Just
room.
As no rockets have been allowed onto the moon.
So that's the moon theory. There's also a couple of other theories which are not as ridiculous, which I'm gonna breeze over because they're not as funny.
Okay.
And we don't have all day. One is the Holocaust theory.
Oh.
Where the entire movie is a metaphor for the Holocaust.
Right.
Jack's typewriter was a German Odler,
right?
Which is the German for eagle, symbolic throughout the movie like as the, political power.
Yeah, like the Nazi eagle.
It was a really famous Nazi eagle.
It is.
I know.
The Holocaust Museum. Can I preface this by saying Stanley Kubrick wrote a whole film about the Holocaust that never got made.
Maybe
it
was The Shining, though.
Really into it. It was like a really big thing.
He's made a big point about how, you know, he's quite a political man and he's got no shame in hiding that. But he wasn't able, for red tape reasons, I think, to make his Holocaust movie.
It was he was planning on making it when he died, I think. And I'm pretty sure he got Spielberg to direct it, and then the funding got withdrawn or something. But he was like, it was his life's work. He was writing it like his whole life, and it was a huge passion project for him.
Which is probably so where this might, theory
yeah,
came
come
from.
Into this.
The music throughout, the in-film music throughout is all 1930s and 40s, because they're down in the gold room.
Yeah.
But a number which is comes up a lot is the number 42.
Right.
It appears on Danny's shirt, Summer of 42 is playing on the TV, Wendy takes 42 swings with the bat with Jack, and 1942 is the year that Extermination of the Jews started.
Oh.
So that's the Holocaust theory. There's not much to it.
No.
And then the biggest and probably the most likely is that the movie represents is based loosely on the genocide of the Native Americans. And there's actually quite a lot of signs of this. Like, right. It's never mentioned in the book, but it's mentioned at the beginning. The hotel manager says to Jack that this hotel was built on an Indian burial ground. On the drive to the Overlook, Jack tells Danny about a party of settlers that got snowed in at the top of the mountains and resorted to cannibalism.
That was how I learned about the term party meaning people, because it confused me a lot. I was talking about a party that turned into cannibalism. And I was like, what kind of parties do adults go to? And that was how I learned what party meant.
Oh, okay. Throughout the
that was a really good impression of someone who was interested in what I just said.
I just don't know how to respond to that.
I mean, show me someone else who remembers how they learnt the word party.
That's fair. Many Native American art pieces are around the hotel, like the rugs and stuff like that, and that's addressed.
That's the theme of the hotel, though, isn't it?
Yeah, that's addressed by the hotel owner. He says that. There is a moment where Jack is throwing a ball at a piece of art. on that is sort of it's based on Native American sand drawings of figures holding hands and dressed in blue.
Oh,
like
the twins.
The non-twins.
Oh, okay, I don't
yeah.
know then.
Like yeah, like the twins, but they're not twins.
Oh, okay, I got you. I'm slow.
The opening music is reminiscent of Native American sort of tribal screams. The music playing when Halloran's body is found by Wendy is very tribal, and Halloran is lying on a Native American rug. Dick Halloran is actually thought to be, although he's black and not Native American, symbolic in this of the plight against the Native Americans, he's the only character killed in the film. He's not killed in the book.
Right.
One shot of him while he's in the pantry with Wendy, when he turns to Danny and says, "Do you want some ice cream?" Telepathically. he is standing right next to a can of Calumet, which has a Native American on the label, and they both face in the same direction. A song playing in the Gold Room is called All Forgotten Now, like America's history of Native American genocide. And I've written coincidence in all caps.
I think not.
Shelley Duvall has also chosen to play Wendy over a blonde woman who King would have, King described Wendy as being blonde.
Which just even more so makes you wonder why the fuck she was given that job.
And she's got quite a long face, which are traditional Native American features, apparently. But except for the fact that she's not Native American.
Yeah, if that was the case, you maybe could have just employed a Native American to do the job.
Also, her fashion choices are...
Scarlett Johansson.
Fashion choices are...
Terrible.
Yeah. According to the Scouse kid I hear talking about her on the internet, resembled a Native American.
Right, I'm not Native Americans. Have great fashion choices. Those are horrendous.
They are awful.
They are like Russian peasants in the 80s.
And the blood in the elevator, also not in the book.
Is it now?
Nope. And it's thought to represent the slaughter of the Native Americans.
I mean, that could represent the slaughter of anyone, really, couldn't it?
Yeah.
This blood.
I mean, that one also fits into the Holocaust theory.
That fits into literally any theory that's gone.
It could be that it looks really cool and it's a horror movie. That's some of the top conspiracy theories about Kubrick's work on The Shining.
Cool.
Could have been an episode of itself.
Yeah.
I thought we'd start with one of your favourite films by one of your favourite guys.
I very much enjoyed Groundskeeper Willie's take on The Shining, personally.
The Shining,
yeah. okay, that was enjoyable, but we don't have much time to talk about it, so let me get into it.
Just crack on, reel them out.
That was great, I did enjoy that a lot. The Shining to me is like, I've never found it scary, but it's just so atmospheric and creepy.
Yeah, it's not scary.
It's like disturbing.
I don't really buy into horror movies as such, but I love things that sort of just general disturbing.
Yeah, I find disturbing things a lot more scary than things that are intended to be frightening.
The book is actually scary. It's the first time I've ever been scared by a book.
I've never been scared by a book, and that's always kind of put me off bothering to read horror, because I feel like I couldn't scare myself. Do you know what
King's
I mean?
King's really good because he uses a lot of word repetition and stuff like that.
Yeah, and he also, he's brilliantly descriptive, and he would be doing most of the imagining for me. I wouldn't have to do it.
He's not very good at endings, but he's very good at.
Okay. I might give it a go because I really like the only books I've read by him. I've seen a lot of his films. The only books I've read by him are Needful Things and, what's it called? All Black, No Stars. Full Dark, No Stars. My guy, it's like a collection of short horrors.
Oh, I
haven't
seen that.
That's brilliant. I'll lend it to you, actually.
Do you want to take The Shining with you?
Not going to lie, I won't read it.
Fair enough.
I might do another time. At the moment, not into reading. But, I love both
scene,
of those books.
The 237 scene, I have to... Do you know when Joey puts his book in the freezer? I had a freezer moment. I had to stop reading it. It was so scary.
Oh, that's tempting. I might borrow it off you, actually. Yeah, anyway, we'll discuss that later.
We've got no time!
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry.
Where shall I start?
I'm so sorry about the cough.
Sorry. We can't do much about this. Apologies, listeners. Bethan isn't well, and she's still kind enough to record for you. She is dragging herself up as we speak, but also we're running short on time. We probably won't have time to edit this, so you're going to have to live with it. Kat's taken up her position on her pillar. Let's go.
She is ready.
Okay, I'm going to get... I'm going to do... I'm going to go from your classic horror to my classic horror. So this, on my research document, is called Rosie's Barbie, but it's better known as Rosemary's Baby. So, Rosemary's Baby, often hailed as one of the greatest horror films of all time, stars Mia Farrow as Rosemary, a young woman who moves into an apartment building with her husband Guy, and before deciding to start a family. Maybe I should stop just reading what I've written and actually just say things. When will I learn? So she moves into this apartment building. He's an actor. They get to know their neighbours and stuff, and they decide to start a family. So she gets knocked up. All great. Rosemary soon falls pregnant, but suffers a shitter of a pregnancy and eventually comes to the realisation, as I'm sure many pregnant women have suspected, that her husband, doctor and elderly neighbours are part of a coven who have selected Rosemary to carry the child of Satan.
Of course.
As you can imagine...
This woman may have some mental health issues.
Yeah?
This woman may have some mental health issues.
She doesn't. It turns out totally legit.
Oh, wow.
She is carrying the child of Satan.
Oh, I feel bad now.
Yeah. Have you not seen Rosemary's Baby?
No, I understand the general premise. I'm adding it to the list as we speak.
You should definitely watch it. I definitely just given it all away, but...
I knew the premise. It's famous enough for me to know what happens.
So, obviously, it's a horror film. There's a lot of scary, gruesome things that happen. But what you might not know is that... possibly even more horrific moments during the making of the film. So, during the film, Rosemary's friend Hutch, he's like the voice of reason. He tries to advise them against moving into this apartment building because he's heard like weird things about it being linked to like cults and cannibalism and stuff like that. So he tries to advise her not to. They obviously don't listen and they move in. As she becomes pregnant, she starts off they're all really happy about it, but then she really quickly gets ill, she's getting weak, she's pale, she looks awful, she's gone. He sees her and he's like, this isn't right, you know, and she's like, oh no, it's fine, and he's like, no, this isn't right. So he goes off, looks it up, comes back, he's like, do you know what, I think probably she's carrying the child of Satan, right, you know.
Most likely.
Yeah, but he's like, he decides that it's to do with witchcraft. But before he can tell her about this, before he can tell her about this, he suddenly gets ill, falls into a 3 months long coma, and then dies. Before he can tell her that it's to do with witchcraft.
Oh.
He's like, suddenly he gets ill. In an oddly similar turn of events, Christoph Kmeda...
Who did he tell, if not his wife? Because someone must have known.
What?
Who did he tell?
No, it's not her husband.
Oh, no.
It's her friend.
Her friend. Yeah, but who did he tell?
He briefly wakes up during the coma and tells his friend who's visiting him to go and tell Rosemary to give her a book or something to do with witchcraft.
Okay.
But then he dies. And that's... I think that's how she finds out she has this book that the friend gives her. I haven't seen it in years, so pretty much all my... This is from Wikipedia.
Yeah.
I had to, like, read over the plot again, because it's been so long. Christoph Kmeda, who is the main composer for the film, was messing about with his friends at a party in the autumn of 1968 when he fell off a cliff, fell into a 4-month-long coma, and then died.
Whoa.
Or as I worded it, fell off a cliff and into a coma. He landed in a coma.
Why do they always put those at the bottom of cliffs?
I know, it's ridiculous. You'd think they would have learned by now. Due to the heavy religious element to the film, the writers and production team received sustained criticism and complaints from religious fanatics, I can't speak, particularly the Catholic Church, A year later, in 1969, producer William Castle received so much hate mail that he developed kidney stones from stress and worry. While medicated in hospital, elements of the film haunted him in the form of hallucinations, and at one point he was heard screaming, "Rosemary, for God's sake, drop the knife." And he was so moved by the experience that he never really made a popular film again, film again. Just ruined his career. This is so short compared to yours, by the way. I'm like nearly dead.
It's like the rest of mine are a lot shorter.
The most famous casualty of the curse, obviously, was Roman Polanski's wife. Do you know her name?
Oh! Oh my God, what's her name?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sharon Tate.
Thank you. I was going to call her Shelley.
Shelley Duvall. We can only wish. That's awful. Roman Polanski's own pregnant wife, Sharon Tate, who a year after the film's release was brutally murdered along with her hairdresser, Jay Sebring. Polanski's friends, Wojciech Frykowski, sorry Poland, and Abigail Folga, his girlfriend, and a friend of Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski's like housekeeper, William Parent, by the Manson family. They obviously followers of Charles Manson. I mean, do I really need to explain this if you listen to this kind of podcast? But they went up to their house in Salo Drive in LA. They thought it seems like it was a case of mistaken identity because they had recently rented that house, and the people who previously lived there was Terry Melcher, who was a music producer and had refused to produce Charles Manson's music, and he had told them to go up and kill everyone inside the house and make it gruesome or something, make it painful.
I was under the impression that it was a war on rich people.
No, he
Well, there was a whole health assault thing.
It was all supposed to seem like, you know, significant, and he was a deep thinker and that, but it was basically just, it was like Hitler with his fucking art college. He was like just bitter that this guy wouldn't produce his music. He like, because he was friends with like the Beach Boys and stuff, Manson, and he was like really into his music. And he was convinced he was going to be this brilliant musician, but he actually just wasn't that good.
Yeah.
And he kept leaving tapes at the house and stuff. Not tapes. Leaving cassettes there. I don't know, LPs or whatever. He kept leaving recordings of his music anyway at the house, and obviously
it would have been tapes.
Would it?
80s?
No. No. It was 60s. Like 60s, yeah.
I know what, yeah.
But yeah, he kept leaving music there anyway, obviously. Nothing to do with Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski, but he thought this producer still lived there, and then he told his family to go out and murder everyone there, not knowing that he didn't live there anymore. So it was just a case of bad luck, really.
And then he was like, oh yeah, I did it to make this sort of, this war against the middle and the working class.
Exactly. And they like dipped a rope pig on the wall in blood and stuff like that, and it was all awful. But that was Roman Polanski's wife. Polanski then went on to, you know, do some bad shit, potentially fiddle with his kids. and the author of the book that the film is based on, Ira Levin, nothing bad happened to him in particular, but he never truly acknowledged or enjoyed the huge success that his book brought. And he was racked with guilt over his use of religious themes and all the hate he got from that. And he partly felt to blame for satanic panic in the 80s. He felt like Rosemary's Baby played into that, and he felt bad about it. So, yeah.
Aw, bless him.
Yeah, it still sounded really sad about him. It was just kind of like, he wrote this book, he was a bit iffy about putting the religious stuff in anyway, but then, and then he released it, and it was huge, and then the film was made, and all these people were, like, complaining about the religious stuff, and he was, like, just felt really bad all the way through. It was really sad.
Yeah, I mean, oh, that's Bless him.
Yeah. That's Rosemary's baby. I tried to keep it quick and short. Looks shit compared to yours now, but
right, I got some short ones.
Yeah, we got a few to get through, so.
I've added Rosemary's Baby to the film.
Good. It's such a good film.
I'm pretty sure most of the films on this list are now going on there because I think I've already seen The Shining.
It's kind of like The Shining in that it's even if you don't enjoy like horror films or whatever, you don't find it scary, it's just an enjoyable film.
I love stuff like that.
Well acted.
Your Satan shit. I find my favourite season of American Horror Story is Asylum. Yeah.
So you were going to say Apocalypse, which is the one about Satan.
No, but you know, like in Asylum when they've got all the.
The nun witches, and all that.
Oh my god.
I know what you mean, but I can't remember the word either.
So, going off that, I'm trying to pick which is the best segue.
Okay.
Behind door number one, we have witchcraft.
Okay.
And behind door number two, we have Satan.
Oh. Now, out of those two things, I am more interested in Satan. So, whether you want to leave that to last or
we'll go for witches. Mix it up a bit.
Yeah. I mean, there wasn't a lot of actual witchcraft in Rosemary's Baby, so maybe we'll get that one out of the way.
Yeah, fair enough. So, in 1996, there was a teen movie about a group of outcasts who were rumoured to be witches. New girl Sarah, the protagonist, is telekinetic and they form a coven. I've not seen this movie.
Me neither, and I've got a t-shirt from it.
This movie is The Craft. We need to watch it because it sounds awesome. It sounds exactly like the sort of thing I'd love to watch.
I kind of wish we weren't doing this, or you're not going to tell me what happens, but, you know, whatever.
I still don't know what happens, mate. Oh, I was good. Very vague in my research.
My feelings about The Craft, I've always never fancied it because I'm not that into, like, witch stuff, but the amount of people, the people I know who love it are, like, all really cool people who've got good taste, so I'm kind of like, that alone is selling me on it. And I've got a t-shirt of it, so.
Ooh. Well, there we go. So, The Craft, the writers and producers actually hired an actual witch as a Wiccan consult for the movie. Ooh. So she would then go and consult with her covens, I'm not reading, her covens, to ensure that all the chanting was real and that it was as true to Wiccan life as possible. The only thing that they didn't change, but in when they wrote it, the god that they mention, Manon, isn't real, because they didn't want a bunch of teenagers chanting to an actual god.
Yeah. That's really good, actually, because, like, I can't imagine obviously, I don't think witchcraft now is real, but if you did, which a lot of people do, this is a genuine thing, like Wiccan isn't whatever. Like, that must be so irritating, because so many people must get it wrong, and you're just sick of that. So that must mean a lot to people that
they hired this Pat Devin, who was really, really keen to do it.
And it shows that they're not just cashing in on something like that or taking the piss with it, they're taking it seriously as a religion. That's really cool.
Firuza Balk, who played, is that how you pronounce it?
I have no idea, Firuza Balk, I think.
Yeah, who plays Nancy, was also a practicing Wiccan and ended up, when she was researching the role, she used to go to this pagan shop, and she ended up buying it after production. Oh,
that's nice. She's in Almost Famous.
Is she?
It's my favourite film.
I know it is. But some creepy stuff did actually happen during the filming. There is a scene on a beach where they are lighting a fire and chanting. And despite it being low tide and the ranger telling the crew that there's no way the tide's going to come in, every time they started their incantations, a wave would appear out of nowhere and wash out the fire.
Dicking with the moon.
Yeah.
You didn't like it.
During this scene, a colony of bats appeared and would linger on set. And when Nancy started calling for the spirit to fill her, the set lost power.
Oh, I'd be out there and then I'd be like, nah, fuckers. Nah, ain't worth it.
There was a white owl that seemed to follow the cast and crew to different locations everywhere they went. Maybe this snowy owl.
Do you think he's like their friend? He said to protect them from the bats. He's gonna fight the bats.
He just ate all the bats. Yeah. He's hoping Morwood appears. He's like, give me the bats. Then the text read from the book in the movie, The Invocation of the Spirit. The text itself is actually from a real Wiccan book called The Book of Ceremonial Magic.
Oh, that's cool.
And on the last day of shooting at the beach, one of the actresses asked Pat Devin, the Wiccan advisor, to dedicate it to the path of the goddess, and they did. Oh. And her Wiccan name was the name that Pat Devin would have given her daughter if she'd ever had one.
Oh.
Yeah. I really want to see this movie. I deliberately didn't read much about the plot because I really want to see it.
I want to meet Pat Devin. I'm scared to give me a name because my name's stupid. I think the owl. I think his owl friends were like. I've heard there's loads of bats hanging around this set, but like, if we go, they're gonna get pest control and chase us off. So like, send Gary because he's white and he looks the most like he'd be like a good omen or something. So send him, he can bring the bats back for us. I think that was a purposeful choice on the owl's part.
I think it's Pat Devin's familiar.
Do you?
Yeah.
I think the owls were having us on. I think they knew that he looked all. He was like, all my life I've had people bothering me in the street asking me if I'm like a witch's friend or whatever. So I'm gonna find me place to use.
I think that's right.
Those kids. Yeah. Well said.
And that's the crap.
Oh, that was a nice
that's
one.
A nice little one. Nice. See, I can do short stories.
Yeah. Okay. Ponging back to me.
Ponging.
Let's do.
What's the matter, Evie?
Was that it?
Yeah.
So I think it was outside. Let's do A Nightmare on Elm Street.
Ooh.
Did I have to think about whether you were interested in that then?
For some reason, I thought I had done that one by mistake. Oh, I haven't. It's fine.
Have you seen any of The Nightmare on Elm Street?
No, you know, I don't watch horror movies.
Yeah, I guess so.
I don't need to. You could tell me all the interesting stuff that happens.
Not a scary one. It's a funny horror, Nightmare on Elm Street. Watch Dream Warriors, though. You'll like Dream Warriors.
Okay.
I found out recently, and I had no idea about this, right? Like, obviously, there's like a million Nightmare on Elm Street films. There's like 8, something like that. But then, a couple of years ago, they made one called Wes Craven's New Nightmare, and it was meant to be like a meta Nightmare on Elm Street, where it was like Wes Craven is being haunted by Freddy, and like the girl who plays the main girl in Nightmare on Elm Street, the actress was in the film and stuff, and he was like, you were the only one who can save them, Heather Langenkamp. You've got to do it. She's like, why me?
It's like Fight
it
Club
looks
too.
Terrible, but I really want to see it. Anyway, okay, so in 1984, the world was introduced to one of its most recognisable horror icons of the time, of all time, even, Wes Craven's Nightmare on Elm Street. That's not the horror icon, it's Freddy Krueger. it's a new
Craven
sentence, that's why. Yeah, that would have made sense. Wes Craven's Nightmare on Elm Street subverted... What a word. Subverted the idea that a bit of common sense and avoidance of abandoned houses will keep you safe from a gruesome horror trope death, as Freddy Krueger crept into our dreams, both on and off screen, and slaughtered his victims in their most vulnerable state. Should I not be like a fucking film review writer or some shit?
Also, Groundskeeper Willie.
Yes. This is a thematic Groundskeeper Willie.
This is a Treehouse of Horror episode of Jenny.
We're a Groundskeeper Willie appreciation podcast now. And while this may seem to be merely the stuff of nightmares, there's actually more truth to it than we would like to believe. Dun, dun, dun. No. In 1975, as Laos's civil war came to a close, this is quite the turn. We're in Laos. A civil war came to a close, a genocidal communist group called the Pathet Lao took control of the country, Particularly at risk were those of the Hmong province, many of whom had served as anti-communist soldiers who'd helped rescue US pilots during the Vietnam War. As such, many of the Hmong residents fled to America for safety. No. However, they were far from happy here and found a vastly different way of life difficult to adapt to. Very few of the refugees spoke English. I'm going to stop writing it and then reading like an essay in future, but I've committed to it now. So sorry, listeners. Very few of the refugees spoke English, and their religion, animism, which is the belief that everything's got a soul, it wasn't recognised in the US, so it was, you know, they didn't feel at home. I know the idea of foreigners not feeling at home in America is, like, crazy for us to believe, but that was how things were.
It's alright, because Trump is building a wall around Colorado, apparently, so...
Around Colorado?
There's a clip of him, he's like, we're building a wall around Colorado, it's going to be the best wall, and they just cuts back to the CNN report, and he's wetting himself, like... Who's going to pay for that wall? New Mexico is on the border of Colorado.
Oh my god.
There's like a whole wall of states separate.
Did you see the White House Halloween party? They had like a pin the tail on the donkey, but it was build the wall. And the kids were like sticking bricks on the wall.
Oh no.
Also, can I just quickly say while we're on the topic, which has nothing to do with Freddy Krueger, there's a... So I was doing a bit of light Facebook stalking the other day, fell down the rabbit hole, and some woman I've never met in my life. But her child, one of her children was called Billy, B-I-L-L-I-E-G-H.
Oh, no.
And the other one, really hope she doesn't listen to this, by the way, because that was, you know, she's obviously going to know who she is. But her other child was like a young kid from the valleys, right? He wrote a letter to Trump, like, praising him for his fucking wall. And she had, like, on Facebook a picture of the fucking letter that, quote-unquote, Trump sent back to him, being like, thanks, young man, for enjoying my wall ideas, or whatever.
It's probably...
That is fucking insane. Yeah. Anyway, so... the move fostered to remember the people from Hmong... of run away to America because they were friends with America during the Vietnam War, and now they've fled, but they don't feel very at home in America because America.
Yeah.
The move fostered extreme anxiety in many of the refugees, so much so, in fact, that within a short time of reaching America, many of the refugees had sought medical advice for imaginary venereal diseases and parasites. So they were, like, seeing stuff. They were so stressed out. Soon after arriving...
Can you imagine you had an STD, though, of all the things to imagine?
That's, like, major hypochondria, isn't it?
To go to the doctor for a fake STD.
Yeah. Soon after arriving, 18 of the otherwise physically healthy refugees were found dead in their beds. Their deaths were ruled as probable cardiac arrhythmia.
All of them?
18 of them, yeah.
On the same night?
I don't know. Okay. It was 18 but of still. The refugees from the Hmong region. The thing I was reading made it sound like 18 people fled from Hmong and all of them died. But that didn't seem like many people from one region, so I'm thinking it was just 18 of the people who fled.
Okay.
But I could be wrong. It could have just been 18 people who fled. I don't know. I do know it was one woman and 17 men. But anyway, 18 of them died. The deaths were ruled as probable cardiac arrhythmia. But another possibility, which they didn't really want to discuss the coroner, I don't know how death works, was Oriental Nightmare Death Syndrome, which is not a very good PC name. but it's now known as Sudden Unexpected Death Syndrome. The condition is prevalent among Hmong males, as well as Filipinos, who... basically have a scary nightmare and then just die of fright in their sleep.
a condition claims 0.04% of the demographic every year. In Asian culture, the condition is believed to be more mystical than that. The Hmong people call it Dab Swam. The Filipinos call it Batibat. But Kat's correcting me. She's very rude. The Filipinos call it Batibat or Bangangot, and the Japanese call it Pukuri. Whatever you want to call it, the spirit comes in the form of a woman and drags men's souls to the spirit world while they sleep. In the Filipino version, the Batibat sits on men's faces or chests, smothering them to death, and as such, many associate the condition with sleep paralysis. The victim will usually let out a sudden scream and then just immediately die. And basically, Wes Craven read a news report on that, and that was how he decided to do Nightmare on Elm Street.
You can see the year written, and the rest was history.
And the rest was history.
Stop
reading my notes, bitch.
Sorry. I knew I was going to get...
I had a row for looking at a picture you were showing me.
I'm sorry.
There we go.
Wow.
So it's basically...
I like how... as Westerners, we've gone, oh no, we're just going to put it under that vague title of sudden unexpected death syndrome, which is a thing, because nobody knows why the hell it happens, but that's not a thing.
What?
Sudden suds.
Yeah.
They're like, they've got a name for it, and it's about them dying in their sleep, and we've just gone, oh, we'll just put it in with all these other things.
Yeah.
Under the carpet it goes.
Yeah.
True story.
True story.
True story.
Who knew that it was a documentary? Not me.
But now you do.
Now I do. I don't think these women are burnt janitors who dress like Kick Bang, but who knows?
With gardening gloves.
With gardening gloves. Yeah.
And fedoras.
And fedoras. I really wanted a pair of shoes as a child, right? But I was never allowed them. They were Vans, like the slide-on ones, right? Not slide-on, slip-on. They glide onto your feet. And they were like the pattern of his jumper and the colours, and then on the sole, it was like his skin, like all his burnt skin.
Oh,
on the
that's
foot.
So cool.
It was awesome, but they were like crazy expensive and hard to get.
I can imagine they were.
Yeah. What have you got next for us? I'm ponging it over to you.
Oh, I'm gonna volley this.
Don't pong it back. I've just
done catch it. That's how pong works. Hit it over, hold it for a bit. Shall we go to Satan now then?
Yeah.
Now seems like a good time to go to Satan, doesn't it? Is this my last one?
Pay him a visit.
Or is it not? No, it's not. It's fine. Because I've got like 7 on you,
yeah.
I'm not going through them all. So, another film that is based on a true story is The Exorcist.
Ooh.
So, on the list of movies that we accumulated, we had like 3 Exorcist-ish movies. So I've gone for the classic Exorcist. The Exorcist is based on a true... That's such a hard word to say, and I'm going to be saying it a
exorcist.
Lot. It's based on a true story of a months-long exorcism by Jesuit priests of a 14-year-old Maryland boy. He was called Roland Doe.
What a stupid name.
No, that's his... It's not his real name. That's his fake name.
Oh, like Jane Doe.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh. I was pretty sure,
instead of calling him John Doe, which is the sensible thing to do,
yeah.
I think his real name was Ronald, because I've read that somewhere. So they just changed the letters around. And I was like, no one will know, it's fine.
Oh.
And this happened in 1949. So, Roland was living in Maryland, it's part of the Doe family.
I'm gonna pass Roland Doe. It sounds like the name of, like, do you know if you add, like, the Bash Street Kids or something, and there's one like kid, and it was written in the 70s, so it's okay to laugh at fat kids, and
yeah.
That's what they've named him is Roland Doe, because he's fat and it's funny.
Gotta be the 70s.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's that kid from the Goonies, isn't he?
Yeah.
Roland was very upset. He was despondent over the loss of his beloved Aunt Harriet, This was a spiritualist woman who taught him many things, including how to use a Ouija board.
Ah, shit.
Shortly after her death, that Ouija board I thought would be interesting and useful, but it doesn't come up at all in the rest of the story.
Okay, then.
It's just, that's the kind of woman Aunt Harriet was.
Yeah.
She introduced him to...
Look, we've all got an Aunt Harriet, okay.
I am the Aunt Harriet.
Yes.
Shortly after her death, Roland began to hear scratching sounds from the floors and walls of his room. Water was dripping inexplicably from pipes in the walls, and more shockingly, his mattress would suddenly move.
Oh, Aunt Harriet, man. Didn't cause water damage.
The family consulted a lot of doctors and psychs and the Lutheran minister. None of these people could help, but the minister...
Well, no, you're a plumber.
...suggested the assistance of the Jesuits.
Plumber?
But the plumbing's not going to stop the mattress moving.
Well,
I honestly think it's mice.
Yeah, maybe.
They're scratching in the walls, they've just gone under the mattress and are wriggling it around like they do on cartoons.
Like 700 mice.
When ants take picnic food.
They do that a lot, don't they?
So, in February of 1949, Father Hughes, the local Catholic
preach.
Preach.
What's up?
Priest. Began to perform an exorcism with the permission from his seniors and his and Roland's family.
Do you know if a priest wants to do, I don't know if this was the case then, but nowadays, if a priest wants to do an exorcism, he's got to get direct permission from the Pope.
I think he got permission from the seniors.
I apologise. You don't have to be a man to be a priest anymore.
I didn't know that it had to be the Pope.
Yeah, you straight up got to get it from the Pope.
Oh, wow.
The big man.
So he began to perform. I know he got advice. Was that permitted by his seniors? As far as I know. He stopped the rite when Roland broke off a piece of the spring from the mattress he was strapped to and started lashing the priest over the shoulders.
Oh, shit, enough.
So Father Hughes was like, I am out.
Yeah, fair.
Bitches.
What was he expecting?
I know, like, what a fucking coward.
Yeah.
Like,
so he's going to be one of those nice, gentle, giggly exorcisms.
Yeah. He just wanted tea. So a few days later... Red scratches appeared all over Roland, forming the words Lewis, or Louis, L-O-U-I-S. His family saw this and immediately jumped to the apparently correct conclusion that they needed to visit their relatives in St. Louis to help this out.
I was going to say St. Louis.
Yeah.
Genuine.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So, when they were there, they were, one of their cousins or something worked in the university who... suggested they go see the two Jesuits, Father Halloran and Reverend Bowden.
Another Halloran.
I know.
Oh.
Just so you know that Pages does not like the spelling of Halloran. Oh. It's just flashed up to me everywhere. They agreed to perform the exorcism. When they went to see him, they witnessed that he had scratches all over him and that the mattress was moving violently. Just as it had in Maryland when the last exorcism had failed. Father and the Rev.
Would that be our band name?
Definitely. Which one's which?
You're the Rev. Going by
you're
that jumper, I think you were Father.
Yeah.
You're Father Ted.
You're like, it's like the Edge.
Oh, thanks. I'll take it. Oh, he was in
The Police?
No, very different band. Avenged Sevenfold. Couldn't have been much different to the Police. The Rev was in Avenged Sevenfold. He was
Edge.
Oh, he's in YouTube.
Oh, yeah. Right, yeah, not the Police at all, really.
More similar than Avenged Sevenfold.
Yeah, he was. You're not wrong.
No.
Yeah, well, that's why you remind me of
I'll
a man
take
in
that.
A
I'll
top
take
hat.
It. Yeah.
Am I thinking of Slash now?
Yeah, you are.
Oh, for God's
Rev
sake.
Has like a... He has one of them terrible pinstripe fedoras, there's I think.
A season. Oh my god! There's a music video for "Seize the Day" where he is wearing a top hat on
the coffin. Like November Rain. Yeah. Yeah.
That's what I was thinking of.
Yeah. Okay. I'll allow it. We just want to name drop every musician who's ever created music.
Yeah, but wrongly.
Yeah.
I actually know music. Dad, please don't disown me.
Please don't disown me either, Bethan's dad.
So, anyway, Father of the Rev noticed Roland was really calm. I've written Roland, like, it's the most normal thing.
Roland.
Father and the Rev noticed Roland was really calm and normal in the day. But when he had settled in bed, he'd exhibit strange behaviour, including screaming and wild outbursts.
Oh, nightmares.
It sounds like it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But Roland would enter a trance-like state.
Well, when his eyes were shut and he was, didn't move for about 8 hours. And start making
guttural noises.
Snoring. Oh, they'd possibly lose their shit if they saw me in bed.
Possibly not related to sleeping, the priest would see mysteriously flying objects in his presence, and noted he would react violently when presented with any sacred object.
Okay, I mean, to be fair, can't stand sacred objects when I'm sleeping. Last thing I want to see.
Get them on my face.
Get them away from me.
At one point during the week's ordeal, the week's long ordeal, several weeks. At one point during this ordeal, which lasted more than 1 week, Bowden, that's the Rev, by the way, the Rev reported seeing an X appear in scratches on Roland's chest.
Right.
Which the priests believed to signify the number 10. Or the number of 10, that I've written.
I would think it signifies the spot. That's what X's usually signify.
So they've established from this number 10 that he was possessed by 10 demons.
There's 10 of us in here, just so you know.
It's really cramped. So the exorcism would continue every single night. Now on March 20th, Roland pissed himself over the bed.
Again, a child.
And he's 14, to be fair.
Yeah.
It's a bit old for nocturnal enuresis, I'm just saying.
What the fuck did you just call pissing the bed? Try yourself smart.
Anyway, he began shouting and cursing at the priests the night that he pissed the bed.
He's embarrassed he pissed the bed. This was all a ruse to hide the fact that he's a 14-year-old bed pisser.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Shit, act like you're possessed. It wasn't me, it was the 10 devils.
A pitchfork shaped pattern of red lines were going from his thigh and snaking down to his ankle.
Sick.
But, yeah. Excellent tattoo idea, am I right? Anyway, so after the night when he pissed himself and started yelling and swearing at the priests, Mum and Dad go, right, you know what, enough is enough.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's time that we actually saw a real doctor for the first time in this weeks-long ordeal. So they took him to the Alexia Brothers Hospital for more serious treatment. About a month later, the Monday after Easter, so Easter Monday, as I believe it's called,
Roland... Surely there was a name for that Monday around Easter time.
Roland awoke with seizures and yelled at the priest, saying that Satan would always be with him. The priest...
Not what you want to hear on Easter Monday.
Is really not. The priest laid holy relics, crucifixes, medals and rosaries on him. And then at 10:45 that evening, the priests called in to expel Satan, shouting at him and saying that Saint Michael would battle for him for Roland's soul. 7 minutes later, Roland came out of his trance and just said, he's gone, mate.
Sick.
He recounts a vision of Saint Michael vanquishing Satan on a great battlefield.
Oh, imagine and then he Saint legitimately Michael challenging your devils to a duel.
That's
for
really
you.
Cool.
Class.
And then he legitimately lived happily ever after the end.
Aww. Nice one, St. Michael. Why didn't he come forward sooner?
It wasn't Easter Sunday.
Well, you have to do it on Easter. Or if you get possessed like the day after Easter, you go wait to
no, no, what it is, see, is that this is the first time that the father and the Rev thought, oh, you know what we should do? We should tell him the St. Michael is coming.
Oh.
And they said that.
Like, oh, shit. I owe St. Michael £30. Let's run.
7 minutes after they said that it was done, they were like, oh, for fuck's sake, I should have done that ages ago. And that's the true story of Roland Doe.
I don't think the girl in The Exorcist lives up there, Raffalo, is she? I can't really remember, to be honest. I hated The Exorcist. It was a terrible film.
My mum was terrified. She won't let any of us watch it.
I just don't accept that. I know it was a different time when it came out, but I can't imagine that was ever scary. I don't accept that people were ever scared by it. I don't care how many other horror films you've seen. It's just a shit film. That and, what's the other one? Fucking Witchcraft. Blair Witch Project.
Yeah.
Shit. Don't bother, listeners.
And that
That was more interesting than the whole film. Well done.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Okay,
there was no head turning and crawling and pea soup and stuff.
And insulting his mum and stuff.
Yeah.
Your mother says God's now. Sorry, Beth and Zach. can I tell something... a groundskeeper Willie-esque fact, something I found out recently, which you know in a scary movie when they do The Exorcist, it's Nikki off Orange Is the New Black, who's like my favourite.
She's the best one.
She's by far the best.
Yeah.
I think I'm a little bit gay for it. I love it.
So, I'm gonna name you some people now, and I want you to tell me what they have in common.
Okay.
And you know already, because you've seen the list of what's coming up.
I really don't.
Norman Bates.
I do know.
Buffalo Bill. Dr. Oliver Thredson. And Leatherface.
Ed. Mother. Fucking Gee.
Cindy, why are you whispering?
I'm not, I'm rapping.
Okay.
I'm remixing.
Your head's going
good. How do you say it? Do you say gain?
I say gain.
Oh, I say gain, see. But the Americans have shamed me into saying gain.
Well, he is American, so yeah, they probably know.
But he's probably still wrong, isn't he? This wrong about shit. They call Anthony's Anthony's. Like, that's wrong. You don't say the fucking H. It's some culture, America.
So... Ed Gein has inspired a lot of movies and books. Psycho, the inspiration, the novel and the movie. he's the inspiration for Norman Bates. Texas Chainsaw Massacre is the inspiration for Leatherface.
Can I really quickly put something in that I wanted to say earlier and then I forgot to say it and you just reminded me about it again. So you know you were saying about, you might already know this, you know you were saying about, I was going to call him Stalin then. What fucking, Stanley Kubrick, Stalin Kubrick, what he did to Wendy with him like stressing out and shit. Have you heard about how, I can't remember anything in the world. Psycho director. Hitchcock.
Yeah.
How Hitchcock treated the woman from The Birds. I'm not even going to try and remember her name. Hattie something.
I think I saw this when I was reading.
Yeah, he was
like mentions that
horrendous
offhand comment, like comparing Kubrick to Hitchcock.
I don't think that's fair on Kubrick from what I read about him. He was awful to her. He made her so stressed that she had a nervous breakdown and was hospitalised on like from set.
Oh,
they had to carry her off because she couldn't walk because she was so hysterical. When the birds were like attacking her, he deliberately didn't tell her they would be real birds. So they were like, she was literally being attacked by birds and she was terrified. And he put it in a contract so that she couldn't work other than on his films. And then he didn't give her work for 2 years on purpose, so that by the time she was out of the contract, she was like a nobody. And she hadn't worked for ages, so she couldn't get any more work, and he just destroyed her career.
Oh, what a prick.
How fucking awful is that? And they reckon the reason is because he kept, like, coming on to her, and obviously she wasn't interested. She was this stunning, like, 60s beauty, and he was this foul man who was obviously a pig. And he kept coming on to Anne because she weren't interested. That was, he just made her life hell.
Oh,
which is horrendous. So I just wanted to put that in because I wanted to say really, and then I forgot. So
that's fine.
Crack on.
So yeah, Ed Gein, inspired.
Much like Albert Hitchcock. What is wrong with me? Oh my god.
Norman Bates in Psycho, Leatherface in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs, and the most famous of them all, Oliver Threadson, the Doctor from Season 2 of American Horror Story Asylum.
I knew the name. Yes.
That's actually my first memory of American Horror Story. It's not watching it, it's you telling me about it.
Is it?
And telling me the Silo from Heroes makes a nipple lamp.
That was in one of the episodes. That was on you. On the podcast, I mean.
No, the first time we were in your friend's house.
Yeah, no, we had the discussion on the podcast about it because we were talking about, I said, it was on the dead, on the dark web one, and I was saying, I'm just reliving the podcast.
We were talking about Ed Gein and
the belt. Yeah, we were talking about the nipple belt, and I thought it was a belt, and you were like, no, it's a lamp.
Yeah, and that's why I thought it. So.
Good times.
Just, this is just going to be a very whistle-top tool. of Ed Gein. So Ed Gein was a murder and body snatcher from Wisconsin. He would exhume corpses and fashion trophies from their bones and skin. He murdered two women and skinned their corpses. But he would deliberately seek out graves of women who looked like his mother, which is where Norman Bates comes from.
My man Norman.
So Norman Bates had a very unhealthy relationship with his mother, and when she died, kept his body and would dress up as her, and it was weird.
Can I just say, if anyone young is listening to this, do not be put off by the fact that Psycho is black and white. It is such a good film. It's one of my favourite films of all time.
I've not seen it.
Have you not?
But I've seen,
you
would love it. Bates Motel, which I absolutely
love.
That
kid is great as a...
As it.
In the role.
Psycho's on my list.
You would generally would really enjoy Psycho.
No, I've always
I'm more than happy
would.
To watch that with you. What's his name? Oh, fuck, I'm not going to think of his name. But the guy who plays Norman Bates. I fancy him. That was the point I was going to make.
But yeah, so Ed Gein would seek out the graves of women who looked like his mother. And he began quite shortly after his mother's death. He started creating a woman suit so he could, in his words, crawl into her skin, which is where Buffalo Bill comes from. Buffalo Bill being the character who would finds a great big fat person.
Oh, and, a great big fat person.
skin her, keeping her... to put lotion on her skin or else she gets the holes again.
Put some lotion in the basket or else it gets the holes again. Would you fuck me? Oh, fuck me. I'm fucking too
low. Fuck me. She puts the lotion in the basket.
Put the lotion in the basket.
But yeah, he would make people, women's skins out of women. Anyway, that got a bit out of hand. I haven't got much on Ed Gein, but I've got a list of the things they found in his house.
That's all I want.
You don't give a shit about.
I can't have time for details.
So, a wastebasket made of human skin. Human skin covers on the chairs.
Do we need to say the human skin? Or is that implied?
Good point. Skulls on his bedposts.
Ooh.
Bowls made out of skulls.
Oh, skulls.
The thing is, though, skulls have a lot of holes in them. I know.
But, but you chop the top bit off.
Yeah, the spit has a lot.
That.
Oh, right, skull caps.
Yeah.
That makes more sense. Okay.
It's okay. You don't have much experience with it, don't worry. But take it from me.
Yeah.
That's the best way to do it next time you're making a skull.
Bowl. That's good. Because I was just, the soup kept just falling up the nostrils. It was really difficult. A corset made from a female torso, skinned from shoulder to waist.
It fit well.
Only if she was a great big fat person. Oh wait, is she a great big fat person? Leggings made from human leg skin.
Oh my god. He's putting lotion on us so his skin stays nice, so when he skins out. That's never occurred to me before.
Oh my god, really?
Yeah, he's I just accepted the lotion thing and never questioned
it. He's treating the leather, and the reason he keeps them for so long is because so they starve.
Yeah, I knew that, but
yeah.
That's just occurred to me. I just accepted that. I was like, he's keeping a prisoner, but he don't want it to dry out.
Anyway, masks made from the skin of female heads.
Oh, and that's where Leatherface comes in.
Mm-hmm. An entire head in a burlap sack of one of the women's that he murdered.
Was that like TBC, or was that it?
No, they. After the women died, that's when they found Ed Gein. So right. They went to his farm because someone had seen him, or what it was. I can't remember which woman it was, and I don't have the name in front of me, but her son had couldn't get hold of her in her shop, and the last person to be in the shop was Ed Gein, because he'd ordered a bunch of turpentine or something. Yeah, basically. And so then they went to his farm and found all this.
Oh, imagine how much you'd shit yourself if your mommy was missing and then you found out the last person in the shop was Ed Gein.
Yeah.
Also, you don't want him in there, do you?
No, you don't.
Oh, so, but was the hat the finished product or was he about to use it and then he never got onto it? That's what I'm asking.
The hat?
The hat, the head.
Oh, no, I'm assuming that, because it's shortly after the death. And then a heart of either the same or a different woman in a plastic bag just popped in front of the stove.
Oh.
It specifically told me in the article that it was a pot-bellied stove on Wikipedia.
Because like, that's relevant. The details you want to know.
9 vulvas in a shoebox.
Oh.
Excellent band name.
That's going to be the first album of the what is it? The Vicar and the Reverend?
The Father and the Rev.
Daddy and the Boy? The Father and the Rev.
Father and the Rev. Nine vulvas in a shoebox.
Coming at you, spring 2020.
They also found 2 other vulvas, which were about 15 years of age.
Vulva revolver. Velvet revolver.
Velvet revolver.
That's what we're calling it.
I just told you about 2 15-year-old vulvas. Like, vulvas belonging to 15-year-old girls.
They are 15-year-old vulvas, to be fair.
And you're like,
not wrong.
Velvet revolver. Oh! A belt of female nipples.
That's what we're wearing on stage as Velvet Revolver.
4 noses. That's like a rest.
Like Michael Jackson.
I'm laughing too much. Lips. On a window shade dressing.
What?
Like, is a window shade dressing just a curtain?
Well, it sounds like blind. A nice name for a curtain, yeah.
Just lips on a window shade dressing.
Lips.
And a lampshade made from the skin of a face.
I don't think he's found the best use for lips. I feel like there's a better use for lips, you know? Like, they're a whole shape for a start. Like, donut shapes, or
being, like, on the chain or something?
There was something on a chain. There was, like, something, like a, I don't know, like a boob or something on the end of, like, a light chain switch or something like that.
A window shade drawstring is what I meant to write about dressing. So, yeah, so that's on the pull cord.
That makes sense.
Yeah, so that's Ed Gein.
Remarkably like a minor, doesn't he, in that
picture?
He does, picture.
Yeah.
I've always thought that. I don't know why, because he's not wearing like a lampshade on his head or anything.
It's as minor as I want to do. It's not even a day cap, though, is it?
No. Mm. It's like a train conductor's hat, isn't it?
Mm.
He's very chiselled, isn't he, Ed Gein?
He's gaunt. That's probably why they called him the ghoul, the Plainfield ghoul.
Yeah, chiselled might be. I feel like it's the sort of skin in people is what makes him ghoulish, you know, rather than his appearance, but
maybe.
Yes, I'm just saying he's got some great dimples.
So, he was found guilty but legally insane, so he...
Fair, I feel.
He died in the Mental Health Institute, dying of liver cancer and respiratory failure at the age of 77.
Cracking.
And he's in an unmarked grave.
Good.
Fuck you, Ed.
Yeah.
That was a nice quick little one, but I thought you'd enjoy the list of body parts.
Yeah, nice little dip into gore. I like that. Right, I am gonna round us off with the true, not the true story, the cursed story. Mm. The story of the curse of the crow. Okay, in 1982, a man called James Barr, who was an orphan and grown up in foster care, lost his fiancée at the hands of a drunk driver. Understandably struggling with the cruel hand that he had been dealt, a bit dramatic, O'Barr poured his frustrations into a comic book character called Eric Draven, who is murdered alongside his fiancée Shelley by a street gang. Eric is, by poured his frustrations, I meant he made the character. I didn't mean like he was crying on his shoulder. That's what I made it sound like. Eric is resurrected by a crow, who proceeds to guide Eric on a path of vigilantism to avenge Shelley's death. The comic was picked up in 1989 by publisher Caliber, and then 3 years later was developed into a film. The film starred Brandon Lee, son of legendary martial artist Bruce, as the title character. By 92, Brandon had already followed in his father's footsteps and was being recognised as a promising young actor and martial artist. But despite the similarities, however... Stop putting butts in. Despite the similarities, however, 28-year-old Brandon was desperate to break away from his late father's legacy and make a name for himself. And the crow was tipped to do just that. So on the 31st of March, 93, they had 5 days left of filming and only 3 days left with Brandon on set. And he was due to film the scene in which, where they, him and his fiancé were murdered. So basically, his fiancé's in their apartment, and he walks in and she's being raped by a gang, a guy called Funboy, I think is the leader of the gang. He goes after him afterwards, but he walks in, she's being raped by him, and then they murder her and they shoot him and he dies in hospital, she dies straight away. And then he's resurrected by the crow, and then he goes out and hunts down baddies and stuff. So they were filming that scene. In the scene, actor Michael Massey was chosen at random to be the one who fired 44 Magnum revolver at Brandon. Even though the gun was real, the bullets were obviously replaced with blanks, which is basically, so like if you're shooting a gun, and I know nothing about guns, this is just what I've gathered, it might not be completely accurate, but like you have the bullet and the charge, and like the charge is the gunpowder bit that propels the bullet out. Yeah. So if they're doing like shooting in a film, they'll either take the charge out so that the bullets come out but there's no force behind them, or they'll take the bullets out so they have the charge and they'll make the noise but you can't see the bullets. So the gun was real but the bullets were replaced with blanks, so that's the charge without the bullets. However, as soon as the round was shot, it was evident that something had gone seriously wrong. Brandon, bleeding profusely from his abdomen, was rushed to New Hanover Regional Medical Center in Wilmington, North Carolina, where he underwent 6 hours of surgery, but, like his character, was ultimately pronounced dead. After a thorough police investigation, it was found that the gun used to shoot Brandon was also used in an earlier scene in which the gun was required to shoot dummy bullets without the charge, so like the other way around than they were doing on the day, but while they'd been doing it, one of the bullets had sort of misfired and got lodged into the barrel.
Oh no.
So then
when the charge went off,
yeah, the next day obviously they were not using bullets so they couldn't see there was one in there, but they were using charges instead, so you combine the two and it's basically just like shooting a gun because it, the charge dislodged it. So basically when he shot him as a normal gun would shoot a bullet, you know. Where am I? Even more tragically, Michael Massey, the guy, the actor who shot the gun, was told that had his aim been slightly less accurate, it was very likely he would have survived.
Why would you tell him that?
I know.
That's an awful thing to know.
I'm guessing they didn't tell him personally, but he found out. it was only his second acting job he'd ever done as well, and like it was
Brandon Lee.
And it was totally random. Like it could have been any of the actors in that gang who shot him. They just decided on the day it would be him. But he was traumatized by it. He still suffered nightmares years later, and allegedly has never watched the finished version of the film.
That's not surprising, is it?
No. I feel really sorry for him, because obviously it was in no way his fault. And what's awful as well is that on the day they had like a Master of Weapons, which is the coolest job title in the world, by the way. They had a Master of Weapons, and he'd been told for that day, like, go home, you're not needed on set anymore. And he was probably one of the few, if only, person
who
would have known to check that and could have stopped it happening. At the time of his death, Brandon was engaged to Eliza Hutton, a book passage that was used on his wedding invitations that they recently sent out was instead used on his tombstone. It said, because we don't know when we will die, we get to think of life as an inexhaustible well, and yet everything happens only a certain number of times and a very small number, really. How many more times will you remember a certain afternoon of your childhood, an afternoon that is so deeply a part of your being that you can't even conceive your life without it? Perhaps 4 or 5 times more? Perhaps not even that. How many times will you watch the full moon rise? Perhaps 20, and yet it all seems limitless. Unfortunately, Brandon's...
He wanted that on his wedding invite.
Yeah, I think it's meant to be like, we haven't got much time, so we might as well spend it together, kind of thing. But it is a bit grim, isn't it? But it's quite
Please remind me not to do that.
I'm just going to put on my wedding invites. Look, might die tomorrow, so I might as well get married now. Come. Unfortunately, Brandon's death was not the only incident that befell the cast and crew of The Crow. On the first day of filming, 27-year-old carpenter Jim Martishu was severely burned over most of his body when power cables made contact with a crane he was in. That sounds horrific, doesn't it?
Especially in a crane.
Yeah, it was just, yeah, and it would have been like a box of electricity, basically.
Yeah. Oh, God.
On the same day, a publicist was in a car accident, a publicist for the film, not just a random one somewhere in the world. A truck inexplicably caught fire. A crew member fell through a roof and broke his ribs. Another crew member stuck a screwdriver through his hand. And a truck drove through the set, injuring the driver. They don't know whether he was like a disgruntled employee who'd been fired and did it on purpose, or if it was just an accident. But he only hurt himself, thank God. On the day of Brandon's death, Entertainment Weekly ran a story about the curse of the crow, mentioning like all the above incidents without realizing what was going to happen on that day.
Oh my god.
That's mad, isn't it? And that is the curse of the
crow. I love how they finished that film by using CGI.
Yeah, because I mean, he literally had 3 days left of filming, like he'd done almost everything, and they got permission off his fiance as well to show it.
I've seen single, like tiny bits of this movie.
Have you?
Yeah, because when I was in...
Have you not seen Psycho and you've seen The Crow?
I was about to explain. I was in A-levels, and you know Dylan?
Yeah.
I went over to his, and he was fascinated by the story of, like, Brandon Lee's death and
stuff. That's why all emos were.
I didn't know anything about all that. You might have told me, I might have ignored him. Sorry, Dylan, if you're listening. I've tried to get Dylan to listen to this podcast, because he would love it. He posted a status up to... Facebook status about Anatoly Moskvin the other day.
Oh, no way! Like,
you know what
Wait, you can hear about that.
Yeah, so, Dylan, if you're listening, thank you for introducing me to the show.
I finished your job for you. I included this picture, because don't he look like if...
Like David Bowie in The Labyrinth.
But an adamant, but like doing ballet.
Yeah, what's with
he's
the gloves?
Got like the little nose sticker and everything. Not that it was a sticker, face paint. It's odd, isn't it? Yeah, but that was from the comic.
He's not
that
doing
was the
stand and
the comic.
Deliver though, so.
That's a bit.
Prince Charming. Prince Charming.
Yeah, so.
I want to know what scene. what the hell happened in that scene of the comic.
That's just him being the crow, you know? Just doing crow stuff.
Just doing crow stuff.
Just doing crow stuff. Just
what crowing. What you doing? Crow stuff. Oh, I loved it. We should do more episodes like this where we have little things.
Yeah, it was good.
So I've got some leftover, which I'm going to pop on the Instagram.
See that they're leftovers.
What?
Doesn't say that they're leftovers.
I have some leftovers.
Yeah, I know, that's what I mean.
I'm not saying I have some leftovers.
Giving them our sloppy seconds that we didn't bother recording.
Well, I've got, well, they're just shorter ones, you know? So okay. They'll make their way to the Instagram.
Yeah. you can also find Brandon
Lee
dancing like a crow.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Obviously, and all the images said.
Yeah, thanks. Appreciate you allowing me to put that on there. So, yeah. Thank you for turning up for you.
If you did.
No, you were talking to. Oh, you did, yeah, definitely.
I did. Not on a regular basis. And not having done the work, but...
I mean, you turned up to everyone. Thank you for not giving me a row when I was researching while we were recording on many an occasion.
Thank you for definitely giving me a row when I didn't respond verbally to you.
You're welcome. I'm glad you've learned your lesson.
I have not.
No, you haven't. And thank you anyone who has listened.
Yes.
Ever.
Please check us out on the Instagram and stuff, because we try to put more content out on there, because yeah, at least that will be somewhat regular.
And we're gonna try and like post things independently of the podcast episode as well, so we're not just gonna put the supporting images and stuff. We're gonna try and put up like
shit.
Yeah, stuff, more interesting stuff that we don't have time to record. So check that out on
Dead Square Podcast on Instagram.
Yeah, Dead Square on Instagram, and then Red A R E A D Podcast, is it?
Yeah, Red A Podcast on Twitter.
On Twitter, like you read it on Twitter. Very funny. Happy anniversary! Yeah, happy birthday! We are one! We are all one together.
We won three.
Oh, okay.
And Father and the Rev will be coming to
you, with their album.
Nine
Bulbs in a Shoebox box featuring the hit single Velvet Revolver.
Bye.
Chop.